A Meeting with Destiny. Savine had attended several parades with her parents and never much enjoyed them. They had always struck her as a lot of pompous guff, and her father's grumbling about the waste of time and money had hardly helped. But she had to admit she was enjoying this one. As dawn broke, the army of Angland filed through Ostenholm towards the quay, where just about every vessel in the province had been pressed into service as a transport. The harbour made a shifting thicket by their masts. Drums thumped, pipes tooted, sergeants bellowed, boots tramp, tramp, tramped. The salt breeze caught flags stitched with old victories. The rising sun gleamed on gear newly forged in Savine's own armouries. And then there was Leo, the magnificent centrepiece to all this pageantry. He was utterly in his element, magnificent in dark grey uniform and gilded breastplate, roaring lions stitched into his cloak. Like a candle flame in a dark room, every eye was drawn towards him, every cheer and salute sent in his direction. He rode constantly up and down on his snorting, pawing warhorse, as though a moment still was a moment wasted, trading jokes with the men, urging them on, standing in his stirrups to wave each company aboard. "They look good, don't they?" he asked, reining in beside her, gazing at the passing columns like a girl at her intended. "They look damn good." "Almost as good as their general," she said, glancing at him sidelong. He reached out and put a gentle hand on her belly. "I love you." Savine blinked at him. The truth was, she had only loved one man, and he was the one they were going to war with. Love was unlucky, an encumbrance. She smiled and pressed her hand against his and felt their baby shift underneath it. "I love you too," she said, and shut him up with a kiss. There was plenty to like about Leo, after all, especially at the head of an army. But there were some tasks he was not suited for. "Wherever is Durand?" she asked as they broke apart. "He organized most of this." Antaup was laughing with a crowd of officers, and Whitewater Gin had stripped off his armour to help heft barrels aboard one of the transports. But she saw none of Leo's other friends. Normally it took a heroic effort to prise them from his side. "And Glarwood? He was meant to..." "They won't be coming," said Leo, jaw muscles working. Savine sighed. "Did you have some falling out in Sapani?" They could be like a gaggle of schoolgirls with their bickering. "Honestly, Leo, we can use every man, and Durand more than anyone. You need someone beside you who
has a brain,"
he forced through gritted teeth. "Won't shit the bed in a crisis," was what she wanted to say, but with Leo in this mood, she settled for, "has a cool head and a gift for organisation. You can't let some petty..." Leo growled each word with furious precision.
"They will not be coming."
"Leo!"
It was almost a shriek, and Savine's heart sank. Lady Finry was forcing her way through the baffled onlookers who had gathered beside the road. The young lieutenant who'd been given the job of watching her hurried after, pink with embarrassment.
"I tried to keep her out of the way, Your Grace, but what's happening, Leo?"
She looked pale and scared and much older than she had when Savine first met her, especially with her son sitting so far above her on his tall, tall horse.
"This must be half of Angland's army."
"All of it."
"But going where?"
"To war, Mother. Where else would an army go?"
"Leo, I've heard a rumour,"
she said the words in a horrified whisper,
"that you mean to move against the closed council."
She gave a desperate, quivery smile.
"Tell me it's not true."
There was a pause.
"They've gone too bloody far," snapped Leo. "Someone needs to stand up to the bastards."
Lady Finry glanced over at Savine, and Savine studiously did not meet her eye, feeling just the slightest bit guilty for the elaborate deception she had worked on the woman.
"Leo, you can't mean..."
She plucked weakly at his knee, at his saddle.
This is armed revolt. This is treason.
Savine felt a chill creeping up her back then, as though in spite of all her long preparations, because no one had actually said the words, she had not realized quite what they were about. That chill became colder yet, as she recognized another familiar face. Yoru Sulphur, that humble representative of the Order of Magi, slipping through the crowds towards Lady Finry's side.
"This is patriotism," snapped Leo. "By the fates, listen to yourself. You don't understand."
Finry dropped her voice, eyes darting nervously over to Sulphur and back.
"Undertakings were made to get us where we are, to get you where you are."
She dropped her voice further.
"I made promises to Baez."
"Baez? What the bloody hell does he have to do with anything?"
"Everything," said Sulphur,
looking very directly up at Savine. She remembered the first of the Magi offering her a statue on the Kingsway, mentioning profitable partnerships and healthy competition, telling her that knowing one's own ignorance was the first step towards enlightenment. And she remembered promising her father she would have nothing to do with the man.
"It's not too late," Finry was pleading. "I can write to the king. We can appeal for his mercy."
Leo gave a disgusted hiss and turned his horse, making his mother scramble back almost into Sulphur's arms.
"I've grovelled enough to that fool. It's high time we switched places."
Lady Finry stared at the marching men, clutching at her chest with a thin hand, then edged close to Leo's horse again.
"Leo, please, listen to me. You're a great fighter. You're a great leader. Of course you are. But what, mother? You're not a general. I seem to remember a battle at Red Hill," he snapped, cheeks flushed red with anger. "I turned the tide there when no one else could. You led a charge."
She caught hold of his horse's reins near the bit.
"Managing an army is a very different thing. Let me come with you at least. Let me..." "No!"
He tore his reins from her hand.
"You've kept me in your shadow long enough. It's my time now."
And he spurred his horse savagely away.
"I wonder how long his time will last," murmured Sulphur, gently shaking his head.
Finry stared from him to Savine. She looked so utterly distraught that it was hard to meet her eye.
"Have you thought about what you're risking? Have you thought about what happens if you lose?"
"There is nothing I have thought about more," said Savine.
Except what would happen if she won, of course. She had already had most of the details of her coronation planned.
"People will be hurt."
Savine was disappointed to see there were tears in Finry's eyes. She really was throwing away all the respect anyone used to have for her.
"People will die."
"And my master," added Sulphur, "will be seriously displeased."
Savine looked down her nose at him.
"As my father once said, if you want to change the world, sometimes you have to burn it down."
"But Baez," pleaded Finry, "our arrangement..."
"Shit on Baez. I did not reach my place in life by paying the interest on other people's debts."
Savine snapped her fingers at one of Leo's aides.
"Escort Lady Finry and her friend back to the Lord Governor's residence and see that they do not interfere."
"Your Grace."
"Leo, please,"
Finry shrieked as she was hustled away.
"Savine!"
But Savine had already turned her horse towards the ships and clicked her tongue to move him on. She couldn't have been much over 16, this girl, but she strode up bold as you like. She had broad, solid shoulders and broad, solid hips and a broad, solid jaw she was intent on aiming at Shivers, however far he towered above her, which was quite the distance as she wasn't tall. She planted the butt of an old spear on the ground in front of him, her broad, solid knuckles white about the time-darkened haft. He looked down mildly at her.
"Hello?"
"I want to talk to Ricker," she growled.
Shivers held out his hand.
There she is.
What, her?
No, said Issa and Ifail. Rikka is the other one-eyed woman with runes tattooed on her face. Yes, her girl. Who the bloody hell else would she be?
Huh, grunted the girl, walking up to Rikka.
You're younger than I thought you'd be.
Give it time, said Rikka. I'll get older.
Or you'll get killed, said Isern.
Rikka sighed. She's always trying to cheer me up. You're a well of good cheer, Isern.
You're Isern Ifail?
Asked the girl, lip even more wrinkled.
No, said Rikka. Isern is the other gap-toothed, tattoo-handed, finger-bone-wearing hill woman. Yes, her girl. Who the bloody hell else would she be?
You three are quite the jesters, ain't you?
Have a smile at breakfast, droned Shivers, stony-faced. You'll be shit in joy by lunch.
Now who might you be, and what might you be after? Asked Rikka.
I'm Corlith.
The girl frowned at Rikka, then Isern, then Shivers, like she was daring them to call her a liar.
And I want to fight!
She snarled the last word like a curse, reminded Rikka of one of those mean little dogs that'll take on anything, no matter how big.
Then fight you shall. We can use every spear. Get this girl a shield, she called to one of the smiths, and Corlith strutted off with her broad jaw in the air, much pleased to be a warrior.
Don't like her looks,
said Isern, eyes narrowed.
You don't like anyone's looks, said Rikka. You're just jealous of her youth and strong hips.
Isern propped her hands on her own hips, such as they were.
I'm the way the moon wants me, and not wrong about it from where I stand.
Rikka snorted.
You're straight down like a sausage, and a grisly one at that.
You're a fine one to talk, skinny Rikka. Every pinch of meat fell off you when you went to see the witch. You're like a head stuck on a spear these days, but without the flies. Most of the flies, at least.
And she burst out laughing.
Harsh, said Rikka,
but by a poor stroke of luck, she was obliged to wave off a fly at that very moment. She chose to rise above it, as a leader should, turning away to take in the gathering. Rikka had called, half expecting she'd be ignored, but folk had answered, and then some. They'd come in a trickle, then a flow, then a flood, from every village, farmstead, and woodsman's hut in the Protectorate. The smiths and fletchers of Ufrith had worked their hands raw the past few weeks arming folk. Then they'd stuck on helmets themselves and joined the throng. Some of the town's women had even taken a break from nattering at the well to stitch Rikka a standard of her own. A big eye with runes around it, like the ones tattooed into her face. The long eye on a red field looking into what comes. It slapped and flapped against its pole behind her now, looking down on the greatest weapon take Ufrith ever saw.
You sure about this?
Murmured Shivers.
Not too late to turn back.
Rikka frowned at him.
Never marked you as a turnabacker.
Shivers only shrugged. He was a tough man to offend. Maybe living with a wound like his made harsh words seem harmless.
I'm for whatever works.
Well, you're a big man, so you wouldn't understand. When you're small, you have to take chances. We might not get another chance like this.
Shivers frowned at the warriors gathered and slowly nodded.
Aye, I reckon.
Besides, and Rikka leaned close and nudged him in the ribs with her elbow, which was something like nudging a tree trunk,
it'll turn out sweet.
She pulled down her cheek so her left eye popped at him.
I've seen it.
Now get him ready. I've a mind to speechify.
You really seen it?
Murmured Isern in her ear.
All you know is what I say I've seen, and I say I've seen it.
Isern winked.
There's the long eye for you.
Listen!
Shivers was calling, but his whispery voice didn't have much poke to it, and no one heard.
Listen!
But it was quieter than last time, if anything. He took another breath.
Open your ears, you fucking maggots!
Screamed Isern Ifail so loud Rikka flinched at it. But silence fell and everyone turned towards her. So many faces choking the square and the streets about it. more of her people than she'd ever seen gathered in one place, more than she'd known she had. Made her heart swell to see them come out on her say-so. She thought of how proud her father would have been as she clambered up on the wall beside Isern, and it gave her a lump in her throat. She pushed back the hood she'd made from Savine's red cloth and tried to scrub some life into her flattened hair with her fingernails.
"You know I'm one of you," she screeched,
voice a bit broken.
"I'll confess I look a touch odd these days, and maybe I am a touch odd, but you know I'm one of you. Born in Ufrith, raised in Ufrith, hope to die in Ufrith. Hope that last'll be some ways off still."
A bit of laughter at that, a whoop or two, and some light drinking. Ricker waved him down.
"My father did all he could to keep this place free." "The Dog Man!"
someone roared, and there was a respectful mumble and grumble of his name repeated.
"Fought all his life so we could choose our own way. But here we are, still stuck twixt the Union and the North. It's like we've a foot on either boat. But now the two are going different ways on the current, and if we don't jump to one or the other, we're apt to get torn in two."
She grimaced and grabbed her crotch.
"And in the most sensitive spot."
More laughter at that. "Make 'em laugh, you're halfway there," her father always told her.
"But now we've got a chance to win our freedom for good."
She reached out like there was something in the air she could nearly grasp.
"It's there, right in front of us. All we need is the bones to take it. And we will. I know we will."
She made a ring out of her finger and thumb and held it to her left eye and peered at them hard through the centre.
"I've seen it."
She flung up her arms, and all those folk thrust their spears in the air and roared with one voice, all bound together in this grand adventure, all ready to risk everything to grab this chance. They were still cheering when she hopped down from the wall.
"Nice speech," croaked Shivers, stroking his sore throat.
"Aye," muttered Ricker, "but no one ever died from talking a good fight."
She rubbed at her own neck like she could rub away the nerves that had gathered there.
"Fighting one's another matter."
The rain had started coming not long after dawn, spitting down on the milling crowds of warriors. Warriors from every part of the north where they called Stour Nightfall king, which was pretty much all of it. There were tough thralls in studded leather with spear or bow. There were stout carles in bright mail with axe and shield. There were named men whose helm and hilt and harness glinted with jewels. There were wild men from the distant north with furs and war paint. There were tattooed savages from out past the crinner with their crooked standards of bone and hide. There were thousands of the bastards. They'd been flooding into the fields around Carlion for weeks. From up here on the roof of the gatehouse, Clover could see the muddy stain of their camp spread all the way up the far side of the valley. But the last day of summer was coming fast, and the camps were emptying now, little trickles of men joining to become streams, flowing down towards the road south, where they became a marching river. Steel gleamed with wet as the drizzle fell, here and there the standards of one war chief or another flapping over the throng. Stour watched this almighty mess with his arms folded, nodding like a baker seeing the bread rise just the way he wanted.
"Ever see a weapon tight lot this, did you?"
Clover shrugged.
"I've seen a few, and by and large they were about like this one. Lots of men turning up with weapons. Sort of the point of the thing."
Stour gave him a withering glance.
"I meant, have you ever seen one so big?"
"I admit this is the biggest, apart from the one when Bethod went to war against the Union, or the one when the Union went to war against Black Dow." But he doubted Stour wanted to hear that, and once you've seen a man starve one poor bastard after another in a cage, you get quite sensitive to what he wants to hear, which Clover imagined was the point of the exercise.
"We're going to show those Union bastards something," snarled Stour. "On their own ground this time.
Never fought 'em in Middleland, eh?
No. Clover didn't bother to say that men usually fight harder on their own ground. He doubted Star wanted to hear that either. Being honest, he wasn't sure why the young king of the Northmen kept him close. He liked to think he was looked on as some noble mixture of bodyguard, advisor, and mentor. In truth, the role probably tended more towards jester. But what can you do but play the role you're given?
You're set on this, then?
Black Calder stepped from the staircase and out onto the gatehouse roof, grey-streaked hair plastered to his pale frown by the rain. He looked sourer by the day, like milk left out in the sun. Stour spread his arms to gather up that whole vast host.
Send 'em home now, they'll be so disappointed. I had a visit from Master Sulphur.
Calder rubbed worriedly at his grey stubble. He'd been pouring worry, doubt, and scorn on the whole business ever since the first man turned up.
He's not happy with this, and that means his master won't be happy either.
Stour gave a snort.
Just as well my business ain't making wizards happy. Be a frustrating bloody line of work, eh, Clover?
I guess, murmured Clover, who found making kings happy frustrating enough.
Dare say you can look after things while I'm gone, said Stour, clapping a hand on his father's back. Managed well enough before you arrived, growled Calder, shaking him off. Though you haven't left me much to look after things with.
And he glanced about the damp roof at the smattering of greybeards, bald-chinned boys, and battle-maimed cripples who'd be guarding Scarling's Hall while their king was off polishing his legend.
Need the men. Fighting the Union's never been easy.
True enough. Bethod, Black Dow, Scale Iron Hand, they'd all found it out the hard way. The Union had been getting the better of better men than Stour Nightfall for years. Stour seemed to guess the way Clover was thinking and gave one of those sly sideways winks of his, like they were all caught up together in the same funny secret.
But we never had Angland on our side before. We had the first of the Magi on our side, grunted Calder, getting even sourer, if that was possible. Tipping all the scales, loading all the dice. When I wanted his help, you said it wasn't worth the price. I said, don't land yourself in his debt. I didn't say spit in his eye.
Calder shook his head grimly.
You don't understand what he is.
Understanding things was a problem for other folk, far as the great wolf was concerned. He gave a hiss, half boredom, half disgust.
When did you turn so bloody sour, father? To hear you carping, no one would ever guess you won the North.
Calder spoke soft.
With Baez's help, I won it. Like the Bloody Nine, like my father. If Baez starts helping someone else, then I'll fight him and I'll win, snarled Stour, showing his teeth.
The sun came out then, peeping through a patch in the cloud, and brought a sparkle from the marching men.
Look at that!
There was a rainbow over the road south towards Ollansand.
A good omen, I reckon. An archway will march through to victory.
Cheers at that from some of the named men on the roof, and weapons shook, and calls of the great wolf. No one mentioned the one thing about rainbows that came at once to Clover. You can march at 'em forever, but you'll never actually reach the bastards. Calder gave a disgusted sigh as he watched the King of the Northmen swagger towards the steps.
The dead save me from the fucking young.
No getting away from 'em, sadly, muttered Clover. The older you get, the more of them there are. As so often, his wit was wasted. Calder was frowning down at his fists, bunched on the grey stones of the parapet.
This was the spot where the Bloody Nine killed my father.
Clover remembered it well enough. He'd held a shield in that duel between the Bloody Nine and the Feared before his name was even Steepfield, let alone Clover, a mad young bastard full of fire.
And his dream of the North United died with him.
Clover remembered the crunching as Bethod's skull was smashed to mush, the thud as his body dropped in the circle.
For 30 years I've been trying to coax it back to life, tending to it with my every breath. We're nearly there, Clover. One victory more.
Clover had his doubts on that score. He'd seen victories enough, and they were like the false summits of a great fell. You struggle towards them, sure you've made the top, then the moment you get there, you see another just beyond. No fight was ever the last. No victory was ever for good. But Black Calder was getting old. He wanted to see his great legacy secured before he went back to the mud. Then he could trick himself into believing it wouldn't crumble a few moments after. He gripped Clover by the arm. He had quite the grip for a thin man.
You have to keep watch on him. You understand me? He's the future. We might not like it. He might not deserve it. But he's the future, and the future has to be protected.
Clover thought of that cage in Scarling's Hall. How do you protect a man from himself?
He'll learn better in time.
Clover had his doubts about that, too. Sooner or later, you have to stop expecting folk to bend around your plans and fit your plans to the folk you've got. But he reckoned Calder had laboured on his plans so long they'd turned hard and brittle and apt to shatter. So he stuck to, It was a contribution that worked for any circumstance. A listener could hear whatever they wanted in it.
If things turn sour over there, do whatever you have to, you understand? Bring him back alive. Do that, I'll see you rewarded.
Said Clover one more time.
Well, I've always liked to be rewarded.
And he set off towards the steps to join the great army of the north. Orso's command tent was, being generous, a shambles. In fact, since Hildy and a group of baffled soldiers were still scratching their heads over how to put half of it up, and Orso had known nothing about leading soldiers at Valbeck a year before, and learned nothing since, one could have said it was a command tent featuring neither tent nor command. Messengers, scouts, and adjutants blundered through in confusion, trampling mud, tripping over guy ropes, and tearing down canvas. Orso hardly even knew what an adjutant was, yet he had about a dozen of the bastards. The babble reminded him of a wedding party held in too small a room, except the guests were panicking and almost all men. General Forrest barked out orders, trying to impose some sanity. Archlector Pike fingered his melted chin, trying to sift truth from conflicting reports. Corporal Tunney watched it all from a folding field chair, the steadfast standard propped beside him with an air of knowing amusement, which Orso found particularly aggravating.
"Your Majesty," Hoff was wheedling with his trademark wringing of the hands, "I wish you would consider returning to the Agrient, where you can be protected."
"Out of the question," said Orso. "Believe me, Lord Chamberlain, I would much prefer to be in my bed than my saddle, but this rebellion is like a fire in a distillery. If it is not stamped out at once, it will spread, and I have to be seen to stamp it out."
"So this is all about appearances," murmured Vic.
"Being king is all about appearances," said Orso. "An endless performance, with no chance for an encore, and for damn sure no applause. Hildy, you do have my armour, don't you?"
"Course I do,"
she grunted, without looking up from the confusion of ropes.
"You don't plan—"
Hoff looked pale.
"To fight, Your Majesty?"
"Bloody hell no, but I plan to damn well look like I might." There was a crash as a messenger tripped, reeled into a table, and sent rolled-up maps bouncing about the tent.
"That is enough!"
shouted Orso. "Forrest, Pike, Tunney, Teufel and Hoff stay. The rest of you, out!" He would not have minded ejecting a couple of those named, but he supposed he needed all the help he could get. "Gorst, make sure we're not disturbed."
"But—"
muttered Hildy around a cord she was gripping in her teeth while she tried to tie two others together.
"You two, out!"
Hildy shrugged, let go of the ropes, and with a gentle flutter, one wall of the tent billowed out and slowly collapsed to the ground. A fitting metaphor for Orso's campaign so far, he rather thought. He spoke through gritted teeth.
Let us take one thing at a time. Your Eminence, is there any sign of the rebels?
No reliable sightings so far, Your Majesty, said Pike. But we have eyes on every beach, bay and wharf. If Lord Huygen told us the truth, we expect them to land tomorrow.
Any trouble from the breakers? Move now, and they catch us with our trousers well and truly down.
Pike glanced over at Vic, standing with arms tightly folded. She shook her head. All quiet, Your Majesty, said Pike. We struck them a blow at Valbeck from which they have yet to recover.
I wish I believed it, said Orso, but I have a feeling that blow only made them angrier. What about our own forces, Forrest?
We have about 9,000, including the resurrected Crown Prince's division.
An excellent decision to raise troops in secret, Your Majesty, broke in Hoff. It may have saved the Union.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves, said Orso.
There will be members of the Open Council who have stayed loyal, I'm sure of it. I have sent letters demanding their support. I doubt they'll be falling over each other to help. I may have implied that the rebels' estates would be redistributed to loyalists.
Orso raised his brows.
Maybe they'll fall over each other after all.
The King's Own are converging from all across Middleland.
Forrest retrieved one of the maps and spread it out upon the righted table.
We should link up with 2 regiments of foot tomorrow. Then Lord Marshal Ruxted is bringing 4 of horse from Kelne, but there's no saying whether they'll reach us in time.
That cavalry could make all the difference. We need to prepare, Your Majesty, said Hoff. Tread carefully, play for time, gather all the troops we can.
But the best moment to strike would be soonest, growled Forrest,
tracing the wiggly line that was Middleland's north coast with a thick fingertip.
Before they get a foothold, the best we can tell, they'll be picking up allies of their own.
So we need to delay, said Tunney. But also move at once.
There was a pause while they all considered that. Orso snorted.
Anything else?
The erstwhile Lord Marshal Brent, said Pike in an emotionless drone. He refuses to cooperate. Orso shook his head.
It's always the last one you expect. I thought the man was a rock. Imaginative as a rock, but reliable as one too. He and my father were old friends.
Nonetheless, he is a traitor. It might be useful to demonstrate our resolve.
I bloody hate hangings, snapped Orso. Maybe we should demonstrate mercy for once.
He has been passing secrets to your enemies for months.
Then he should carry on, said Vic.
Orso frowned at her.
He's under lock and key in the House of Questions, isn't he?
Awaiting the King's justice, grated out Pike.
Vic shrugged. Brock doesn't know that. I could take him a message.
A message saying what? Asked Hoff.
Saying the closed council have turned against each other. Saying the King's Own are scattered and distracted, and there'll be no opposition. Saying His Majesty has fled for Gurkle, with only his standard-bearer for company.
His standard-bearer's got better sense, muttered Tunney.
Saying whatever you please.
Orso considered that idea, and a rare smile began to spread across his face.
You know, Inquisitor, I'm beginning to like you a great deal.
Forrest cleared his throat.
Your Majesty, if that's all, we really should.
And he nodded towards the theoretical entrance to the tent, where Gorst was holding back a sweaty, panicky, impatient crush of messengers. Orso sighed.
Very well. Open the floodgates.
As the boat's keel ground against gravel, Leo leapt into the surf. Sloshing through a few dozen strides of icy water probably wasn't the best thing for his leg, but he was burning to be first ashore. He'd been kept a prisoner behind a desk far too long, caged in ballrooms and council chambers, chained by manners and rules. Now was the time for action,
And what was the point of a leader, after all, if he didn't actually lead? Directing things from a chair at the back was for King Orso and his like, not the young lion. Leo's headquarters would be in the saddle, at the tip of the spear, where the blood was shed and the glory won. It wasn't the most glorious stretch of shore, he had to admit, as his flooded boots finally crunched up onto the beach and he stood to rest his aching leg. A great grey curve of cold shingle, then a great yellow curve of wind-torn grass, then brown dunes and scrubby trees swept sideways, a few lonely birds hovering on the breeze, the only sign of life. No cheering crowds waiting to celebrate their liberation from the tyranny of the closed council. But Leo told himself that was a good thing. They were supposed to be landing in secret. No one in sight was a mark of success.
Jin!
He called as the Northman jogged up onto the beach beside him. A solid presence, no one more reliable.
Set up some pickets while the men get ashore. Antaup! You Grice?
Antaup pushed that lock of hair from his face where the wind instantly flicked it back. A good friend, who Leo was absolutely sure liked women.
Organise some scouting parties. Fan out, see if you can make contact with Isha and the rest of the Open Council's troops. Where's Stour due to land?
If he has good luck with the weather, maybe a few miles that way.
And Ricker?
Antaup puffed out his cheeks as though it was anyone's guess.
The other way, maybe?
Durand would have known exactly where and when they were all meant to arrive, would already have been snapping out orders, making sure everything was going to plan. But Durand... That image floated up again of him and Glaward bent over the bed, their gasping faces pressed together. Leo clenched his teeth.
"We've got to link up with the others right away," he snapped. "With numbers on our side, we shouldn't need to fight at all."
"Right," said Antaup. He took a step one way, froze, then turned back the other and hurried off up the beach. Jin was grinning at Leo, red beard tugged by the wind.
"By the dead, it'd be a shame to go home without a battle, though."
Leo grinned back and clapped him on his mailed shoulder.
"Maybe just a little one."
Orders were being called now, boots splashing in the surf and scraping in the shingle, a reassuring clamour of activity as the men of Angland began to pour from the boats and onto the beach. Leo's standard was unfurled above him, the crossed hammers and the lion, holed and torn from victories in the north, but never taken by an enemy. He smiled up as the sea wind made it flap and flutter, setting his doubts to rest and his heart leaping.
"At last," he murmured.